Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks again for joining me at the Right Take Podcast. Today, I'm honored to say my guest will be the extraordinary author and filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza, and we're going to talk about everything from his brand new book, An Election Fraud, to the media, education, and the state of the culture in America today. So please hang around and don't miss that. But first, I'm going to kick things off with some thoughts on a trend I've been wanting to address, and that is male celebrities trying to make a statement about the new masculinity by wearing women's clothes. I'm not talking about drag queens. That's a whole other topic deserving of its own episode. I'm talking about celebrity men feminizing their sartorial style in order to, they would say, smash gender stereotypes. But it's really to virtue signal to their peers that their masculinity is evolving from the supposedly toxic traditional type to the more emasculated, woke sort. Now, I know what many of you are thinking. Who cares about the effeminate eccentricities of silly celebrities? Unfortunately, many tens or hundreds of thousands, if not tens and hundreds of millions of people, care way too much about what silly celebrities do. The tragic reality of our pop culture is that masses of mostly but not entirely young people are influenced by what celebrities do and think, which is why celebrity endorsements for everything from products to politicians are so coveted. So when celebrities push a certain idea or cultural trend, it ultimately affects all of us, as the culture gets steered in that direction, usually going off the rails and dragging the rest of us with it. So what's this strange trend of famous men dressing like women all about, and where is it leading us? Let's look at a few examples. Actor Brad Pitt, to name one, raised a few eyebrows a couple of months ago when he appeared at the premiere in Germany of his latest film, Bullet Train, wearing a linen skirt. Later, asked about the inspiration for that look by Variety magazine, which is the showbiz industry rag, he explained, "I don't know, we're all going to die, so let's mess it up." Well, first of all, "we're all going to die, so nothing matters and let's just get crazy" is a really juvenile, destructive philosophy to live by. Yes, we're all going to die, and it's good to keep your mortality in mind, memento mori and all that. But the point of that awareness is not to take it as a license to indulge yourself in any socially transgressive whim, but to get you to focus on what's really important, to take your life, your purpose here among the rest of your fellow citizens, and the state of your soul seriously. Secondly, as much as he tried to make it sound like his wearing a skirt was just a whimsical bucking of social convention, there's a more serious undercurrent to it. As he himself later revealed, it's part and parcel of the left's narrative that men and the women who love them are both oppressed by the wearisome burden of traditional masculinity. In a recent interview with the Financial Times, Pitt, who was born in Oklahoma and raised in Missouri, expressed his frustration with the kind of men he grew up around. He said, quote, "It's just exhausting to be anything but who you are. You have to understand, at least where I grew up, we're more the Clint Eastwood character. You hold everything within, you're capable, you can deal with anything, you don't show weakness. I see that in my dad and the older generations of actors, and man, it's exhausting," unquote. Well, maybe it's exhausting for Brad Pitt, but Clint Eastwood himself is going on 93 years old now, and you don't see him needing to take a break from all that wearying masculinity and relaxing in a skirt at the premieres of his films. You never saw that in any of the men's men of Hollywood past. Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, Gary Cooper, Marlon Brando, Paul Newman, John Wayne, Kirk Douglas, Humphrey Bogart, not one of those celebrity icons of masculinity ever felt the need to shake things up by wearing women's clothing. It would never have occurred to them, and their fans, both male and female, would have been repulsed if they had. But we're living in a time now in which traditional masculinity is demonized as toxic, not by ordinary people, but in the culture. And so there's a lot of pressure on men in the public eye, like Brad Pitt, to be relevant and to demonstrate that they are evolving toward a new masculinity which frees men of all that exhausting, strong, capable behavior and allows them to be who they really are, which is women. Pitt's co-star in the movie Bullet Train, Latin pop megastar Bad Bunny, I'm guessing that's not his real name, was praised for wearing a dress on the recent cover of the women's fashion magazine Harper's Bazaar. Apparently, he's been interested in women's clothing since he was a child, and now fame has given him the confidence to do, quote, whatever I want and wear what I want so I get to live life more authentically, unquote. Bad Bunny was featured in skirts and dresses as a spokesperson for a clothing line in a campaign called Le Splash. And back in May, at the 2022 New York Met Gala, the singer wore his hair up in some kind of a bouffant and walked the runway in something with puffy sleeves and a detachable skirt. He told GQ magazine that he prefers skirts to pants. I'm happy for Bad Bunny that he's living his most authentic life, but let's not pretend that he's representative of some desirable next stage of masculinity. And maybe you've heard of the singer Harry Styles. I'm not familiar with his music. He used to be with a band called One Direction, which sounds like a boy band to me, but I don't know. He's also an actor, and I did actually see him in a small role in an ensemble cast in the riveting movie Dunkirk about the evacuation of Allied troops pinned down on the French coast in World War II. And I confess I thought he did a great job, so maybe he's a talented guy. But he also has made just as much of a name for himself as something of a style icon by wearing women's clothing or mixing and matching men's and women's articles of clothes. For example, he made waves by appearing in a dress and other feminine clothing for a layout in the December 2020 issue of Vogue magazine, including on the cover. By the way, that's one more cover of Vogue than the petty, bitchy fashion industry ever allowed former First Lady Melania Trump to have, an actual model and an actual woman. Anyway, Styles has a very, let's call it flamboyant style, and is often cited as one of the celebrities setting the tone for this new, less masculine masculinity. Now, artists adopting a gender-bending style is nothing new in pop culture. Rock stars going back as far as the young David Bowie, for example, have indulged in this androgynous look and behavior, but that was different. Everyone knew that that was just rock stars flirting with sexual taboos. No one was claiming it represented an advancement to the next level of masculinity. Speaking of the aforementioned GQ magazine, this leads me to Will Welch, the 41-year-old editor of GQ, which used to be a style magazine for grown men, but for the last couple of decades, it's been a propaganda outlet pushing progressive politics and targeting a much younger readership. Welch has a tattoo on his hand of the words, "Want nothing," over the outline of a desert island. Why is it always the most privileged, affluent cultural elites who put up the biggest pretense of yearning for the freedom of owning nothing? You don't see anyone in poverty-stricken areas anywhere in the world sporting a virtue-signaling tattoo about freeing yourself from the burden of possessions. This is a first in history, by the way, this pretentious indifference toward, or even rejection of, the capitalistic success that has made ours the most prosperous, comfortable civilization in world history. And it's entirely a feature of today's obscenely privileged anti-capitalist left, like the editors of fashion magazines. Anyway, 4 years ago, when Will Welch was named editor-in-chief of GQ, he set about remaking the magazine, which had been led by the raging leftist LGBT activist Jim Nelson for 15 years. Under Nelson's tenure, the magazine ramped up the progressive politics and promoted activists such as naming notorious national anthem kneeler Colin Kaepernick as GQ's Citizen of the Year. Nelson also granted unhinged political performance artist Keith Olbermann a twice-weekly GQ web series promoting his hate-mongering commentary on the 2016 election. And then, during the Trump years, Olbermann was given a series at GQ.com pompously titled The Resistance, as if Olbermann were some sort of courageous freedom fighter. Part of the remake under new editor Welch was a change of GQ's stance on what it means to be a man. He said in an interview, quote, "In my first days as editor, I just had this language, the new masculinity, because the culture was demanding that men change, straight up. It was an important moment for us to do two things, reflect on this moment where the culture was demanding that men evolve, and lead, and show men what that evolution might look like," unquote. To announce his vision of what that evolution might look like, GQ released a fall 2019 cover featuring singer and producer Pharrell Williams in a sort of quilted gown-like coat, bracketed by the words, "The New Masculinity Issue," in a very frilly font. More recently, GQ's August 2022 cover features the aforementioned star Brad Pitt lounging on a bed of flowers in an electric blue Louis Vuitton shirt, quote, "looking like a cross between David Bowie and Joan Crawford in her later years," unquote, as one critic put it. I'm assuming that critic didn't mean for it to be flattering, because I don't think a cross between anyone and an aging Joan Crawford sounds like a good look for a man. But hey, maybe I just don't get the new masculinity. About this word evolution, progressives use that word a lot in recent years in terms of masculinity. It implies that men are dinosaurs, stuck in some kind of prehistoric stage of development, and need to be guided toward a higher, more enlightened form, by which they mean less masculine and more feminine. Not just metrosexual, which refers to a narcissistic level of personal grooming, something most women don't like in a man, but really embracing one's supposedly deeply repressed feminine side. Here's an example. A recent article noted that the next films in the James Bond movie franchise will have bigger roles for women and a more sensitive 007. This is according to producer Barbara Broccoli, who was quoted as saying, quote, "Bond is evolving just as men are evolving. I don't know who's evolving at a faster pace," unquote. Well, I can tell you where the Bond franchise is going to evolve to if they feminize Bond: bankruptcy. A feminized Bond is quite simply not Bond. Okay, back to GQ. Editor Will Welch has said, quote, "We're not saying men of America dress in a gender-neutral way or wear women's clothes," unquote. Yes, he is. That's exactly what they're calling for. That's what the cultural elites are telling men now is dress like women. Better yet, become women. The absolute high point of cultural identity now is to identify as the opposite sex, and preferably commit to that by surgically mutilating your body and blasting it with irreversibly damaging hormones. Our cultural elites now demand that you not just tolerate, but celebrate this satanic inversion of nature. All of this celebrity nonsense sounds silly and pathetic, and it is, but it's indicative of the confusion about masculinity, the subversion of masculinity that has been sown by the progressive elites. It's reached the point where movie stars are virtue signaling their rejection of traditional masculinity by flouncing around in women's fashions and pretending that this is some kind of higher plateau in the evolution of manhood, and that the old masculinity, in the days when men weren't pressured to act like women, is obsolete and poisonous. The upshot of all this is that masculinity in America and the Western world in general is in crisis, for a number of reasons, not just because of Hollywood effeminacy. But a primary reason is the left's propaganda that traditional masculinity is a repressive mask, a toxic straitjacket, and that men can only free themselves and live authentically, like Bad Bunny, by throwing off those chains and becoming more like women, including by literally dressing like them. What's the goal, the end game of all this? I'm glad you asked. It is the eradication of traditional sex roles for men and women. More than that, it's literally the eradication of masculinity and femininity themselves. And there is a war on femininity, just as there is on masculinity, but that's for another episode. Because then there can be no nuclear family. If masculinity and femininity are literally meaningless, then there can be no mother and father, no sister and brother, no son and daughter. All of those relationships will be meaningless when the definitions are erased. Why do that? Why eradicate masculinity and femininity? Because the Marxist collectivist utopia can never be fully realized until the obstacle of the nuclear family is removed. Remember that Karl Marx explicitly called for the abolition of the family, wanting to replace it with the collective. And the core of that obstacle to today's neo-Marxism is masculinity, the warrior spirit of the family. It's the aggressive, competitive, aspirational energy that forms families, protects communities, and builds civilizations. masculinity, properly channeled through the Judeo-Christian values of Western civilization, built that greatest, freest, most prosperous, and virtuous of all civilizations. The collectivist left hates that civilization and wants to tear it down. To do that, to deconstruct the civilization, they must deconstruct the family and neuter the masculine spirit, the father, the husband, the defender. They must shake things up, as Brad Pitt put it. So when you see Harry Styles on the cover of Vogue magazine in a dress, or an aging Brad Pitt looking like Joan Crawford on a bed of flowers on the cover of GQ, remember that what the so-called new masculinity is really all about is destroying masculinity itself. And on that note, let's shift gears and get to today's guest on the Right Take podcast, the amazing Dinesh D'Souza. Stay with us. My guest today on The Right Take is genuinely a man who needs no introduction, but just because he doesn't need one doesn't mean he doesn't deserve one. Dinesh D'Souza is a best-selling author, an award-winning filmmaker. He's an immigrant who grew up in Mumbai, came to the United States in 1978 as an exchange student, graduated from Dartmouth, and then went on to become a scholar at think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and the Hoover Institution. Dinesh has written about 20 books. Is it 20 or how many, Dinesh?
Well, close to 20. I'm not keeping a close count.
You've written so many, you've lost count, so that's good enough. On a really wide range of topics, from socialism and racism to God and the afterlife, from Obama's rage to Reagan's leadership, books like What's So Great About Christianity, What's So Great About America, Hillary's America, The Big Lie, which is about the Nazi roots of the American left, The United States of Socialism, many more. As if that weren't enough, he has also made 6 documentaries, like 2016, Obama's America, and America, Imagine a World Without Her, which are among the highest grossing political films of all time. Take that, Michael Moore. This year, in 2022, he teamed up with the election integrity organization True the Vote to release what is arguably the most important documentary you could ever see. It's called 2000 Mules. And now he has released a book from Regnery Publishing based on that film, also called 2000 Mules. They thought you'd never find out. They were wrong. And so we're going to talk about that today and a lot more. Dinesh, welcome to the Right Take podcast.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, and I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, it's an honor to have you on. I want to talk about your new book, obviously, but first I would like to pick your brain, if I may, about a variety of topics about the culture war. First, I want to start with education. That is a very hot-button issue in the country right now. Woke indoctrination in the classroom is a serious concern, as you know. My wife and I are among the growing 10% of American parents who are homeschooling their kids. And you and your lovely wife, Debbie, recently wrote and published an educational children's book for the conservative publisher Brave Books. Can you tell us about that and why you felt it was important to do a children's book?
Well, the Brave Books people came to us and they said that they were doing a series for children. They've created a kind of animal world, and they're doing a series inside of that single story. They liked the topic of socialism, and they wanted to convert some of the, well, somewhat esoteric themes of United States of Socialism into a children's book. And I thought, wow, this is going to be tough because, first of all, children don't know what socialism is and how are you going to explain all this? But I thought it was an intriguing idea. Now, my wife, Debbie, is a former school teacher, and she's taught first grade and second grade, but she's also taught 12th grade. So she has a very good feeling for kind of the cognitive development of youngsters and how, in what language, so to speak, you should speak to them. And so we thought if we put our heads together, we could figure out a way to come up with a story. And the Brave Books people helped us to do this, to take the themes of socialism. And, you know, if you think about it, socialism is really ultimately about the issue of fairness. Who deserves what? And what does it mean to get, in a sense, your just desserts? And so that's really the storyline of that book. And I also think it's important to contribute to the culture in various different ways. Of course, I've been doing the documentary films. So this was a little bit of a new genre that I haven't tackled before. So that made it also appealing.
What's the age range for that book that you're targeting?
Oh, it's going to be probably 6 to 12. In other words, there's, obviously people are at different levels, but what the book does is kind of what the old Disney used to do. And what I mean by that is it's really aimed at young people, but there are more mature themes that are lurking behind, so that even a parent reading the story, let's say to a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, the parent will get some things out of it. That will, in a sense, go over the heads of the 6-year-old, but they're there in the book. They're there in the story.
Yeah. Are you and Debbie planning to do any more?
Not sure. Yeah, this was actually a little bit of a diversion for us. In other words, the beaten path for me is the daily podcast. It's the books, the speeches, the movies. And so this is something that I wouldn't normally have seen myself as doing. So I decided to do it once and we'll see what happens.
Sounds good. You have become arguably the most prolific cheerleader for America and conservative values. But we're now in a time, when our country and its values and its history and its founding fathers and even Western civilization itself are under assault like never before. Many Americans have been and are being indoctrinated to just despise our country and its history. What is it about being an immigrant, as you were, that enables you to see America as an inspiration and as a force for good in the world in a way that many young Americans cannot?
I think one factor is that the immigrant is using a comparative, or you may say historical, frame of reference, whereas the native-born American is using, let's call it, a utopian frame of reference. And here's what I mean. If you were to ask Jesse Jackson, he says, America's a racist country, or Al Sharpton, this new fellow, Ibram Kendi, who writes these books on how to be an anti-racist. You say, well, what's so bad about America? He goes, well, not everybody in America is treated equally. And you say to him, well, are you saying that America is a worse place in this regard than, let's say, Ethiopia or Somalia? And Kendi would give you a look like, what are you talking about? Because he's not comparing America to any place else. He's comparing America to, you could almost call it, the Garden of Eden, and saying that using this utopian standard, America's falling short. Well, immigrants don't do this. Immigrants grow up elsewhere. Debbie in Venezuela, my wife, I in India. So we're going to look at America and say, compared to every other place in the world, what are the prospects of an ordinary guy starting in America without a whole lot of cash and maybe even a whole lot of education? What's the chance that that guy can make his way into the middle class or even the upper middle class? And the answer is pretty good.
And along those same lines, if we zoom out, so to speak, and kind of look at the big picture, would you say that Americans and even the Western world in general, who are facing this alternate worldview from the radical left, would you say that we're in a literal fight to preserve our civilization from that kind of perspective? Or isn't that really what's at stake here? Or am I just being way overblown about it?
You know, what I think is interesting is the fact that this American civilization that you're talking about has now to some degree become a universal civilization. The Indian writer, raised in Trinidad, but of Indian origin, V.S. Naipaul, gave a speech that largely focused on the Declaration of Independence many years ago, but it was called America, a Universal Civilization. And the point he was trying to make was that even if you go today to India and you were to talk to people, you find a lot of them are pro-American. And the reason they're pro-American is that they like America, but they like one particular version of America. You could almost say that they like the America of the 1950s. Now, this is not to say that they are, myopic to the fact that there were problems in the 1950s or that the principles of America need to be broadened to include everybody who might not have been included originally. Yes, but nevertheless, there was nothing wrong with the principles themselves. The real issue is that you just want that opportunity to be available to everyone. And this is the American project, I think, that is embraced by people and young people worldwide. Now, it's becoming increasingly apparent to people in India and elsewhere that there is another America. And this is the left's America. And this is a different America. This is a woke America. This is an America that cares less about opportunity and merit, more about redistribution, more about identity politics, more about erasing the line of distinction between men and women, more about erasing traditional standards of morality. That is not an America that I would argue is appealing worldwide. In fact, on the contrary, it's repulsive worldwide. And we can see some evidence that the radical Muslims are pointing to that America as a recruitment tool, are saying, in effect, that America is sort of the leading force of perversion in the world, and that traditional people around the world need to rally against America because this is now what America represents.
When you look around at the cultural and political landscape today, is there one issue that you could say is most concerning to you, or that you feel is the most crucial front in what we often refer to as the culture war?
Well, I think that the frontline issue for me right now is the wholesale assault by the left on principles of basic liberty and principles of basic fairness that are all in one form or the other found in the Bill of Rights and that are supposed to be secure even from majoritarian assault. So the Bill of Rights, as you know, is these are individual liberties. I have a right to free speech, and it doesn't matter if 51% of Americans, a majority, disagree. They don't have the right to suppress me. I have the right of freedom of conscience. It doesn't matter if 90% of Americans practice a different religion. They don't have the right to force me. So these rights are supposed to be insulated, protected, even from the majority, which is a way of saying protected even from the American people themselves. And yet what we have seen, and this to me has been a surprise, is that one by one, each one of these rights has come under assault. It's very hard today to say that in terms of free speech, America is genuinely a free country. Or number two, in terms of the idea that we will not see the use of the state to go after political opponents. That's something that seemed unimaginable 30 years ago. It's now fairly routine. Number three, equal rights under the law. The idea that the law would be applied in a kind of manifestly selective manner to go after certain people and then to ignore the far greater violations of other people just because they happen to be on the other side of the aisle, this, you have to admit, is part of the America we deal with now. And this is something, I think, of grave concern.
Oh, yes, indeed. Speaking of grave concern, let's talk about your brand new book, 2,000 Mules, which, as I mentioned before, has the same title as your astounding documentary from earlier this year. Both the book and the film pose and answer the questions: who really won the hotly contested 2020 presidential election, and was that election stolen? First, let me ask, why did you follow up the film with a book?
Well, this is actually kind of my normal practice. And by that, I mean, really going back to my first film, 2016 Obama's America, that was loosely based on my book called The Roots of Obama's Rage. Later, I did the film Hillary's America with a book. Now, typically, I released the film and the book at the same time. But what happened in this case is that the film outran the book, by which I mean that I wanted to get the film out fast. And so I decided, look, I haven't finished the book, but that's okay. I'm just going to get the film out there. I will then finish the book. It will have, in a sense, more detailed and systematically presented information than a movie can possibly do. It will also include an answer to the critics. So there is more information in the book than there was in the movie, but the two became separated by a few months.
Yeah. You acknowledge in the book that you were initially agnostic, as you put it, about whether or not the election results were valid. And you also acknowledge that there are limits to what can be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. But I mean, the whole issue, I guess, is kind of a Gordian knot of legal, investigative, and moral complexity. Can you briefly describe the methodology behind your investigation into those election results?
Sure. The reason that I stayed out of the election debate and haven't really addressed it for, you know, almost a year and a half before I took on the 2000 Mules project is because all I saw were anomalies. And anomalies are strange events, things like, why did they stop the counting suddenly in five different places on election night? Or how could Trump have won the bellwether counties that normally predict the election and still lost the election? So these are anomalies. But anomalies, although odd, can sometimes have a perfectly adequate explanation. And the fact that you don't know what that explanation is doesn't make the anomaly into a proof. So what I felt was that we might never know what really happened in 2020 because we're receding away from that event. It's becoming, you may say, a cold case. And it wasn't until I began to look at the evidence assembled by True the Vote that I realized, first of all, cold cases can be cracked. The way they're cracked is essentially by using technology that is able to take you back to the original scene in as vivid a manner as if you were there. And in this case, what I liked was the fact that we were looking not at one, but two independent lines of evidence, which had the potential of corroborating each other. So let me give an example of what I'm talking about. You know, if we're talking about a serial killer who went to five different homes, let's just say a year and a half ago, and killed five different people, and using cell phone technology, we're able to identify on exactly what day and what time the killer entered each of these homes. Now, let's say that one of these homes, only one, but one nevertheless, has a video camera. And so you now have a second body of evidence, which is the video evidence. You don't have it for all five homes, and you wish you did. But nevertheless, if the cell phone tells you that this person, Dinesh D'Souza or Mark or whoever, entered the home on a Tuesday morning at 1:30 a.m., and you look on the video camera on that exact time, and there he is, then you have a very powerful type of evidence because the geo-tracking is pointing to the video is corroborating the geo-tracking. So once I saw the evidence that True the Vote had assembled with regard to ballot trafficking, not obviously serial killers, but rather vote traffickers, I'm like, this is an evidence of a caliber that I haven't seen before. And moreover, it's very cinematic, so it lends itself to presentation in a movie.
I have to say, it's both the documentary and the book are just extremely riveting. They're just jaw-dropping, really. You address this in the book, so I don't want you to have to give away any spoilers. But everyone reading this book is going to look at the evidence you present and the conclusions you came to, and they're going to say, "What do we do? How do we rectify this shocking crime, and or how do we stop it from happening again?" Can you talk about that without, giving away the ending of the book?
Yeah, no, I discuss this all pretty candidly throughout the book, and then I take it up again at the end. If the book succeeds in making its case, the implications are pretty momentous, right? Because it suggests that the wrong man is in the White House. And the wrong man is in the White House, not because of some, you know, error of counting, but rather because of systematic and organized fraud in all the key states that decided the election. As far as I know, this is unprecedented in U.S. history. Not that fraud has never occurred before. And it's arguable that in the 1960 election, there was a fraud in Cook County, Illinois, maybe a little bit in Texas, that helped to give JFK the election over Nixon. But we're talking about coordinated fraud in all the key battleground states. So this is a very serious matter. And I even point out that we are in constitutionally uncharted territory because essentially the Constitution says that the votes are, you have the election And then the electors cast their votes, and then both houses of Congress ratify what the electors have done, and then the president basically takes office. And the Constitution doesn't really say, well, what happens if you find out later that the guy who is sitting in the White House is the beneficiary of illegal cheating by his own side that is responsible for putting him there? The Constitution really offers the sole remedy, it seems, of impeachment. And I point out in the book that that would seem to be an inadequate remedy, because even if you get rid of Joe Biden, you basically get the other beneficiary of the cheating, Kamala Harris, to take his place. So I'm fully aware of the fact that this is not an easy problem to fully rectify.
Yeah. In a country in which the news media weren't simply a propaganda arm of the Democrat Party, this would be the biggest political news story of the decade, if not the century, would it not? But instead is dismissed as a right-wing conspiracy theory. Of course, all the so-called right-wing conspiracy theories of the last couple of years have been proven true. But how do we push back against this false narrative that is being constructed around this by the mainstream media, by government leaders, even by some Republicans, by some Republican leaders, and by left-leaning academics who will eventually write the history of this critical moment in American history? How do we push back against that narrative?
So I think you're pointing to a larger cultural task that really goes beyond politics and really goes beyond the imagination of many Republicans at this point. Many Republicans would be very content if Republicans swept the House and the Senate, paralyzed Joe Biden for 2 years so he couldn't move legislatively, and then if Republicans took the White House in 2024. But it seems to me that, ambitious though that agenda is, it pales beyond what really needs to be done. And what really needs to be done is that we need to create an alternative culture inside of America that involves our own schools and our own universities and our own movies and our own stand-up comedians. In other words, we need to create our own America inside of America. Without that, we will not only be at the mercy of the other side, but we will literally be subsidizing our own destruction. We'll be paying for universities to indoctrinate our kids against us. We'll be paying for entertainment that perverts our values. We will be supporting companies that are doing, that are promoting a woke agenda, and we'll be helping to bankroll it. So this seems to me to be the broader cultural task at hand. And some of the difficulties encountered by 2,000 Mules are because we are in this unlevel playing field. We have media, but it's small. Our megaphones are really small compared to theirs.
Oh, I totally agree with everything you said about the parallel culture. Conservatives generally don't make very good political activists. We don't like making politics central to our daily lives, unlike the left. We don't community organize that well. And it's hard for someone who isn't you to help move the needle of the culture unless they own a movie studio or a cable network or something. Can you offer a couple of suggestions as to what the average American can do in this culture war to help sort of create and support, as you mentioned, this parallel culture?
Well, there have to be things, there can be things that are done by the ordinary citizen, but there also needs to be a lot of things done on, let's call it, the supply side. What can the ordinary citizen do? Well, in the area of election integrity, what you can do is you can participate in the actual election process. I'm not talking about just going in and voting. And I agree with you that for many years, I would just go vote, pull the curtain, cast my ballot, assume that the process itself was sound, that the votes were going to be accurately tabulated. One of the points I make in the movie and in the book is that while Republicans focus on the campaign, Democrats focus on the election, on the actual administration of the election. Where are these mail-in drop boxes going to be located? Who is going to be taking the ballots out of them and filling out the custody documents? Who will open the envelopes and decide if the signatures really match? Republicans don't think like this, and it seems to me that we need to, and the way to do that is to get more Republicans into the process as poll judges and poll watchers. And quite frankly, we need eyes on these mailboxes. Now, it is in the election rules that these mailboxes should have 24-hour surveillance, but the simple fact of the matter is many of them don't. And I think that if they don't, we need to make sure that somebody is surveilling these Dropboxes. Because if you once the Dropboxes are properly surveilled, it's very difficult for the mules to do what they do.
Just to get back for a moment to the narrative I mentioned being constructed about the election, excuse me, you know, immediately in the wake of the election, Democrat leaders and the left-leaning news media colluded, basically, to smear anyone who was concerned about the validity of the outcome and described it as what they called the big lie. How many times have you heard the media use that term, the big lie? And they smeared those who were concerned about the results as election deniers, which you have to believe is intentionally worded to echo the term Holocaust denier. And of course, we consider Holocaust deniers to be awful people, if not actual neo-Nazis. So, and what's funny is the left has a long history of election denial itself. But anyway, anyone legitimately skeptical of this patently suspicious voting result has been demonized as a threat to democracy. Is the left intentionally pushing Trump supporters and conservatives, generally speaking, to a kind of a breaking point by demonizing us in this way in the hopes that we will prove them right about how we are the real violent threat to democracy?
It seems to me pretty clear that that is what they are trying to do. They are trying to push us over the edge and then go, see, we told you. And they're doing it using a very creepy playbook. Now, a lot of conservatives think that this playbook goes back to Obama, but I think it actually goes back even earlier to Bush and to the kind of the war on terror. Because if you followed some of the cases, which, to be honest, I was inattentive to and even a little blind to at the time that they occurred, it's only in retrospect that you go back and look and you begin to realize, wow, this pattern of kind of staging events in order to create a narrative or to support your narrative is something that that the FBI actually became good at. In the aftermath of the war on terror, because basically the FBI, after 9/11, probably, Mark, you and I would have predicted that there are going to be a lot of other incidents like this, but there weren't. And so what happened is that the FBI realized that in order to keep the issue on the forefront, and not to mention keep the level of public anxiety high and keep the money flowing into the budgets of the deep state, they sort of had to create terrorism where none existed. And so what they would do is they'd go to a couple of Syrian guys who were, you know, students at NYU, who are basically radical Muslims. And they would say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to blow up the United States. But of course, these guys lived with their moms. They didn't have passports. They couldn't possibly join Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And so what does the FBI do? They go, hey, have you ever thought about, you know, they have an informant. Have you ever thought about joining ISIS? Oh, I don't have a passport. Well, how about if we get you a passport? Would you consider traveling to Pakistan? Well, yeah, but I don't have any money. Well, how about if we give you money? Would you consider taking an air ticket? Well, yeah, I guess in that case, you know, and then they bust them. Wow, look at us. We're amazing. We just busted this amazing terror plot and these guys want to join ISIS. If you look at that playbook, it is not far removed from the Whitmer kidnapping playbook, which is not far removed from the January 6th playbook. So, yes, I think that there is a conscious effort supported by digital media through censorship, promoted by the media to try to validate the idea that Trump supporters are not only critics, but are sort of violent domestic extremists who need to be put on watch lists and who need to be treated as enemies of the state.
And with that in mind, would you say, as someone on MSNBC did last month, that what all this points to is that we are actually in a sort of a cold, or maybe even not so cold, civil war in America?
I think that is a clinically accurate phrase, and I would say that what makes the whole thing so creepy is that. See, the left has almost had a virtual takeover of the main institutions of the culture, including some institutions that were previously considered conservative. I mean, who would have thought that the FBI would be taken over by the left, or the CIA, or the Defense Department, certain divisions of the police, or the Boy Scouts, or even large corporations, which always had some prominent Democrats in them. But I think if you took a survey of corporate CEOs circa 1980, probably the majority of them would have leaned Republican. So the cultural takeover by the left is frighteningly complete. And even though politics is divided, culture in that sense is not divided. And this is why I say it's not always up to the ordinary guy. If we want to encourage conservative comedians, we need to provide some alternative to the improvs, where young comedians kind of cut their teeth and gain experience and become better at what they do. If we're going to fight the woke universities, I don't see a way we can take, 300 universities back. We have to think of new ways to create online education that is so world class and costs so little that it essentially destroys the existing model of higher education. So all these things are doable, but they do take money and a lot of creativity to do. The same in a smaller scale is true of the kind of movies I do. When I first went to investors to talk to them about movies, they were, they didn't even understand what I was talking about, because it was so unfamiliar for them to put money into a film. But I think there's now a slowly developing awareness of the task ahead, and it's coming late in the game, but it's better late than never.
Let me ask you a question about the American experiment. I know some conservatives look at what's going on in the political and cultural arenas, and they say, "Well, we're screwed. The American experiment is over." And it had a good run while it lasted, but it could not hold out indefinitely against the left's pursuit of the will to power. So it's done. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the American experiment?
Well, that's a hard question, because I find myself, there are certain things that give me grounds for optimism. On the other hand, we have seen an unraveling in the last few years that is at a faster pace than I would have thought possible. Just think back 10 years or 15 years, if you looked at the technological community, it was left on cultural issues, but fairly libertarian on economic issues. So to put it differently, it was economically conservative, but culturally liberal. But what's happened in the intervening decade is that the tech moguls made so much money that the economic motive, you may say, almost went off the table. And so they succumbed almost completely to the cultural left. And now you have the Biden administration literally giving marching orders to tech platforms, censor this guy, take that guy off. And I mean, think of it. What is the meaning of the First Amendment, which says government shall make no law, Congress shall make no law restricting free speech or freedom of the press, when the government is working almost fascist style hand in hand with tech platforms to achieve things that would be unconstitutional if the government itself did them directly?
Well, I think that sounds like a good note on which to end this. Dinesh D'Souza, thank you very much for your time, your great insights. Thank you for joining us on The Right Take. Please keep up the great work, sir.
I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure.
The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.